I'm told that language is one of the most distinctive achievements of the human species. Nothing apparently separates us from the apes more decisively. Maybe you saw on the television this week that some enthusiastic young fellow has tried to teach, I think it was an orangutan, some elementary vocal responses. He used special speech therapy techniques devised for autistic children. And after spending a great deal of time and energy on it for about 6 months, succeeded in teaching this creature to use, I think, about half a dozen simple sounds. That's about the best you can do with an orangutan. He was rather pleased with himself. And yet, you know, a human infant at the age of 3 or 4 is putting together original sentences. Sentences he's never heard before. Piecing them together without any great intellectual effort, apparently, out of vocabulary and syntax, which he's quite literally picked up at random by overhearing the largely unintelligible conversation of others. It's a very remarkable feat. In fact, there's a whole science of linguistic psychology which is trying to understand it. Many scientists are now convinced that when you learn a language as a child, you learn it by a completely different mechanism from the way you learn language later on as an adult, as a foreign language. They think that the rapidity with which a child learns language must mean that there's a kind of language facility built into the human brain genetically. Human beings are, so to speak, programmed to speak. Well, if that's so, and there seems increasing consensus that it is, it doesn't really surprise the Christian over much, does it? Because according to the Bible, man is made in the image of a speaking God. In the beginning was the Word, says John. Self-expression lies at the very heart of the Trinity. Of course, there's something mysterious about language. Man's ability to understand and use words lies very near to the essence of his divine likeness. So perhaps it's not surprising that a book like Proverbs, written as it is by a philosopher, should take a lot of interest in words. He shows some interest in the Word of God. In fact, one of the most straightforward statements of the infallibility of the Bible occurs in Proverbs. Proverbs 30, verse 5. Every word of God is flawless, says Solomon in 30, or Agur, I beg your pardon, in chapter 30, another sage of the Old Testament. Every word of God is flawless. Verse 6, do not add to his words, or he'll rebuke you and prove you a liar. But in the main, Solomon's attention, the book of Proverbs' attention, is taken up with human words, not God's words. Solomon actually admires words an awful lot. He admires them for their power, for instance. 25 verse 15, he says, a gentle tongue can break a bone. When I was a child on the streets, we used to sing, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. You ever heard that? It's all bluff, of course, because words can hurt, can't they? They can manipulate a gentle tongue, or it may sound very gentle, but it can break a bone. Solomon's quite right. Solomon, being a politician, knew all too well that a diplomatic tongue could sometimes accomplish what 10,000 troops couldn't. You see, in that same text, he says, through patience, a ruler can be persuaded. Haven't you heard that story of the king who was persuaded by a couple of con men to buy a set of invisible clothes and wear them down the main high street? That's why, of course, words are very important in the business of being successful in life. If you've got the gift of the gab, you're probably going to make money. Solomon's very frank about that. 12 verse 14. From the fruit of his lips, a man is filled with good things, just as surely as the work of his hands rewards him. Yes, competence with language is more valuable than muscle when it comes to earning a living, says Solomon. So he admires the influence that words have. He admires, too, their medicinal properties. In 15, verse 4, a tongue that brings healing is a tree of life. I think it was one of the Greek philosophers who called words the physicians of a diseased mind, which I suppose is what psychotherapy is all about. You sit down the person who is mentally disturbed and you talk to them. An anxious heart weighs a man down, but a kind word cheers him up, says Solomon in 12 verse 25. It's therapy. Words. In addition to that, he admires the beauty of words. A word aptly spoken, he says in chapter 25 verse 11, a word aptly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. It's difficult to know exactly what he's getting at there. There's the craftsman's delight in fine expression, perhaps. But I think the chief emphasis is not so much on literary style as the appropriateness of a word to a given situation. Not the studied poetry of the word so much as its spontaneous wit. He says this elsewhere too. A man finds joy in giving an apt reply. How good is a timely word, he says. What the French call a bon mot. Makes the whole conversational context memorable and gratifying, he says. Like putting an apple in a silver salver. In fact, Solomon quite obviously gets a lot of satisfaction out of well-chosen words generally. 16:24. Pleasant words are a honeycomb. Sweet to the soul, healing to the bones. What's he thinking of there when he says pleasant words? Is he thinking of compliments? I can't believe that. Solomon knows better than to be captured by flattery. No, I think he's extolling the delight of good conversation. Hazlitt said of Coleridge, he talked on and on forever. And you wanted him to talk on and on forever. Words can be very attractive and enjoyable things. They can be influential, they can be therapeutic. All these things Solomon admired words for. But as we've noticed very often in the book of Proverbs, there's nothing romantic about Solomon's view of anything. He's never idealistic. When Solomon analyzed words, he's ready to recognize, too, their potential danger. They can conceal, for instance, as well as reveal a man's heart. Like in 18, verse 4. The words of a man's mouth are deep water, he says. They can destroy as well as deliver. 12 verse 6, the words of the wicked lie in wait for blood. They can depress as well as elevate. 15 verse 4, a deceitful tongue crushes the spirit. What's more, verbal wickedness, says Solomon, spreads at an astonishing rate. 16:27, a scoundrel plots evil, he says. His speech is like a scorching fire. Many of us know that to our cost, don't we? How quickly an evil rumour can spread. What a great forest, says James, is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue is a fire. A whole universe of potential evil among the parts of the body, he says. To say the very least, then, there's something very ambiguous about words. And the reason, perhaps, is implicit in what Solomon says in 15, verse 7. He says there, the lips of the wise spread knowledge, not so the heart of fools. What I want you to notice there is the subtle transition between lips and heart. The lips of the wise spread knowledge, not so the heart of fools. And you get exactly the same transition in chapter 10, verse 20. The tongue of the righteous, he says, is choice silver, but the heart of the wicked is of little value. See, as far as Solomon's concerned, words are the index of the soul. What was it Jesus said? Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. We are judged by our words for that very reason, that our words, more than anything else about us, reflect what we are really like inside. Of course, in this fallen world, pure hearts are rare, and therefore the tongue of the righteous is a valuable commodity. He says in 20 verse 15, gold there is, rubies in abundance, but lips that speak knowledge are a very rare jewel. So there are two sorts of speech, good and bad, if you like, corresponding to two different kinds of heart, righteous or evil, wise or foolish, and issuing in two different sets of consequences. 18:21 says, the tongue has the power of life and of death. Let's look at bad words. What does Solomon have to say about the characteristics of bad words? Well, slander is a good example of that. He talks about that in 25, verse 18. Like a club, a sword, or a sharp arrow, he says, is a man who gives false testimony against his neighbor. In other words, to have somebody tell a lie about you in public is like being battered, slashed, and pierced to the heart simultaneously. But then the insincerity of the crafty man can be just as pernicious in its own quiet way. Like in chapter 26. A malicious man, he says, disguises himself with his lips. Though his speech is charming, don't believe him. Seven abominations fill his heart. That's chapter 26, verse 24. We've all met, of course, that kind of smarmy flattery sometime, even if it's only from the salesman on the doorstep. What we often forget is that this kind of false speech is something we all give way to in certain circumstances, because the truth is often not convenient to us. It isn't conducive to our goals. It's embarrassing, maybe. It's humiliating to our egos. We make excuses. We're not being malicious in telling this fib, we say. It's just a white lie. I think it's perhaps because of the phenomenon of the so-called white lie that Proverbs includes two what seem to be on the surface completely trivial statements. You'll find them in 12:17 and in 14, verse 5. A truthful witness gives honest testimony, says Solomon. A false witness tells lies. Well, there's not going to be much applause for that startling piece of information, is there? It's tautologous. What is Solomon getting at? Perhaps this. Maybe Solomon wants us to realize that truth and falsehood are absolutes. We make excuses for our lives. Circumstances may sometimes mitigate the guilt of a lie, but they don't stop the teller of it being a false witness. Because truth and falsehood are absolutes. A truthful witness gives honest testimony. There's no getting away from that. There are no innocent lies. Even on those occasions, which are perhaps rare, when a lie may be defensible as the lesser of two evils. You know, the situation ethics people always tell you, what do you say when the madman turns up your doorstep and asks if your wife's around because he wants to shoot her? Or maybe there are lesser of two evil situations where you'd be justified in telling a lie. But it's still an evil. For it's a false witness who tells lies and a truthful witness who gives honest testimony. You're not legitimizing untruth by saying that in certain circumstances it may be the only thing you can do. So over against all this caution about deceit, Solomon says a lot in praise of honesty. Like in 24 verse 26, an honest answer, he says, is like a kiss on the lips. Well, maybe some of us would prefer a kiss on the lips, but nevertheless Solomon is convinced. Maybe it's less complimentary to give us an honest answer. Maybe the buttery charm of the flatterer is a great deal more to our liking sometimes. But no, an honest answer is by far the most loving thing anyone can do to us, he said. It's no good getting offended if you ask somebody's opinion and then they tell you what you don't want to hear. You ladies, when you ask your husband whether he likes your dress or your cooking, no point in asking if you're not wanting the truth. An honest answer is a kiss on the lips. Indeed, a person who really loves you, says Solomon, won't necessarily wait till you ask him his opinion. He'll tell you what you need to hear. 27 verse 5. Better an open rebuke than hidden love, he says. If you've got any sense, in other words, you'll value the criticism of one who loves you. The kisses of an enemy may be profuse, but faithful are the wounds of a friend. We came across that last week, didn't we? There's one place, of course, where truthful speech is always going to be particularly in short supply. And that's the government. And for that reason, says Solomon, men of integrity may well find themselves promoted in government circles. 16 verse 13. Kings take pleasure in honest lips. They value a man who speaks the truth. It was very interesting when I was in Africa that you noticed quite often that Christians got the difficult jobs in diplomatic circles. Often they came from a tribe or even from a race. Maybe they were European rather than African, which wasn't really politically to the liking of the powers that be. But they often got the job, because there are certain offices in government where the president has got to know the man's going to tell him the truth, where he can't afford corruption. Now, Solomon knew what he was talking about. But of course, when it comes to higher diplomacy, it's vital to be able to speak not only truthfully, but also tactfully. And therefore, that's a virtue which Solomon, being a king, never tires of praising. 21 verse 23. He who guards his mouth, he says, and guards his tongue, he will keep himself from calamity. It's President Coolidge, I think, who once remarked, I have noticed, he said, that nothing I never said ever did me any harm. Think about that one. There's indeed a lot of advice in Proverbs about knowing when to keep your mouth shut. 17 verse 28. Even a fool is thought wise if he keeps silent, and discerning if he holds his tongue. Abraham Lincoln slightly paraphrased it. He said, I'd rather be silent and thought a fool than speak out and remove all doubt. Sometimes, of course, total silence is impossible. But even then, says Solomon, you may well be advised to keep your words few in number. There are many reasons he gives for this. First of all, he says, a man who talks too much is likely to be indiscreet. 12:27, a prudent man keeps his knowledge to himself. The heart of fools blurts out folly. Another reason he gives for keeping your words few is that when you're angry with someone, the more you talk, the more likely you are to lose your temper. 17:27, a man of knowledge uses words with restraint. A man of understanding is even-tempered, literally keeps his cool. It's true, isn't it? If you bite your tongue, you're less likely to lose your temper. I think the same thought probably is what lies behind 10:19. When words are many, says Solomon, sin is not absent. But he who holds his tongue is wise. It's said of Julius Caesar that when he thought he was in danger of losing his temper, he used to repeat the alphabet backwards. I think for some of us it might be more appropriate to repeat the Chinese alphabet backwards rather than the Latin, but nevertheless, maybe it's a good practice. A third reason for not speaking too much, according to Solomon, is very well expressed by a little motto, which I understand once hung in Lyndon Johnson's office during his days in the US Senate. It said simply this: you ain't learning nothing when you're talking. And Solomon agrees with that. In 10 verse 14, he says, wise men store up knowledge, but the mouth of the fool invites ruin. In other words, the difference between the wise man and the fool is that the one is taking in while the other is forever giving out. Another Greek philosopher speculated that the reason God gave us two ears and one mouth or so that we should always hear from others twice as much as we ourselves speak. In addition to the virtues of using few words, Solomon also encourages taking time over what you say. Now again, several reasons for this. First of all, the simple reason that what you say will be much better considered and therefore much more helpful if you take time over it. 15:28. The heart of the righteous, he says, weighs its answers, but the mouth of the wicked gushes evil. See, hasty words are rarely well chosen. Indeed, we frequently regret them later on, don't we? 29:20 says, do you see a man who speaks in haste? There's more hope for a fool than for him. The mouth of a fool gushes folly, he says. Of course, in addition to that, rash speech is often quite simply rude and discourteous. It's not just unconsidered, it's inconsiderate. We're so anxious to talk that we interrupt our neighbour. Why, says Solomon, a person like that isn't going to have much of a reputation with his neighbours. 18:13. He who answers before listening, that is folly and shame. But more than all this, he says the reason for taking time over what you say is because ill-considered words are often the most dangerous, the most harmful words. Like in 12:18, reckless words, he says, pierce like a sword. Always say, I didn't mean him to take it like that. But you see, once the insult is taken, it's very hard to convince him that it wasn't intentional. Now, says Solomon, hear the other person out, think about what you're going to say before you say it, and then express it as concisely as possible. That's his advice. 13:3. He who guards his lips guards his soul, but he who speaks rashly will come to ruin. So words are powerful, and words are dangerous. They're able to heal, they're able to harm. They come in good and bad. Yet it wouldn't do to get too obsessed and self-conscious about our speech, because words do have their limitations. They may be powerful, but they're not omnipotent. It is possible to exaggerate their importance. And Solomon in Proverbs gives us several reasons for these limitations on words. One obvious one is that words are often inadequate unless they're accompanied by our deeds. He mentions this in 14:23. All hard work brings a profit, he says, but mere talk leads only to poverty. In other words, you're not going to achieve success by building verbal castles in the air. You've got to invest labour as well as oratory in your plans. Don't we say when we mock vocal extravagance, don't we? Oh, we say, he's all talk. Well, some people are. And mere talk leads only to poverty. Another limitation on words is the fact that circumstances have a way of exposing fallacious words and so limiting the amount of harm they can do. Boasting, for instance, that tends to come unstuck quite quickly, says Solomon. 27:1. Don't boast about tomorrow. You don't know what a day may bring forth. Circumstances have a way of limiting the danger of your words, you see. A similar sort of limit lies in the fact that people aren't infinitely gullible. Like Lincoln says, you can fool, what is it, all the people some of the time, some of the people all the time, but not all the people all the time. That's true. Sooner or later, indiscreet words will come home to roost. And Solomon agrees with that. 18:6. Foolish lips bring a man strife, and his words invite a beating, he says. So you're going to get it from the person you've insulted sooner or later once he realizes that you've been speaking about him behind his back. Flattery doesn't pay in the long term either, says Solomon, because eventually people realize the insincerity of it and reject it. 29:5. Whoever flatters his neighbor, he says, is spreading a net for his feet. And the next proverb makes it clear that it's the flatterer's feet who are going to get entangled, not his neighbor's. An evil man is snared by his own sin, it says. What's more, in the last analysis, says Solomon, people respect you more for giving an honest opinion than for buttering them up all the time. 28:23. He who rebukes a man will, in the end, gain more favour than he who has a flattering tongue. But I think the main limitation on the power of words, according to Solomon, lies in this: that words depend for their effectiveness totally on the cooperation of the listener. For instance, the value of good words depends totally on whether the hearer takes any notice of them. 25:12 makes this plain. Like an earring of gold or an ornament of fine gold is a wise man's rebuke to a listening ear. It's the listening ear that's important, you see. If the wise man's rebuke falls on a deaf ear, then Solomon might have gone on to say, that's like tipping money down the drain. It's an absolute waste. There's no value in that. Not only value depends on the listener's cooperation, but also the effect of the words. Words can be frustratingly ineffectual. Like in 29 verse 19. There's a tongue in Solomon's cheek as he says this. A servant can't be corrected by mere words. Though he understands, he will not respond. Eh? What do you say, governor? Communication, you see, is a two-ended process. There's no necessary connection between speaking and being understood, and still less between being understood and being obeyed. Wasn't it Churchill who once stood up at a great public meeting called for him to address? And feeling in one of his obstreperous moods, he said, accustomed as I am to public speaking, I know the futility of it, and sat down. Now, words can sometimes be pretty futile. The listener, you see, is a participant in what's going on. Effective communication isn't an action received by a kind of passive receiver. Both ends of the communication chain are active in speaking and in listening. Of course, one consequence of that is that the listener is implicated in any evil that the words generate. 17 verse 4. A wicked man listens to evil lips. A liar pays attention to a malicious tongue. See, our ears can be just as simple as our mouths. We reveal the moral condition of our hearts by what we heed as well as what we say. Be careful, little ears, what you hear, says the children's song. Another consequence of this implication of the listener in what's going on with words is that in the long term, the damaging effects of words are often much reduced because people identify the pretense and the insincerity in them, as we've already said. Like in 26, verse 23, he says, like a coating of glaze over earthenware are fervent lips with an evil heart. The point being, you see, that you can see through that coating of glaze without much difficulty. Even if you're taken in by it, others with more experience won't be. 26 verse 26. His malice may be concealed by his deception to you, but his wickedness will be exposed in the assembly. In other words, the judges and the elders who've got used to listening to liars and sorting out the truth from the falsehood, they'll know whether he's telling the truth or not, even if you don't. Actually, Solomon has some interesting advice on how to spot a deceiver by observing his facial gestures and his physical gesticulations. Kind of a behaviorist lie detector kit. You come across this in 1630. He who winks his eye is plotting perversity, says Solomon. He who purses his lips is bent on evil. A bit of an overgeneralization, perhaps, not without wisdom. In 6:12, he goes further. A scoundrel who goes about with a corrupt mouth signals with his feet, he says, motions with his fingers. In other words, an acute observer will usually notice something that gives the liar away. And thus any benefit that his lie is likely to bring is going to be temporary. 21 verse 6. A fortune made by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor. A con man needs to know how to make a quick getaway, doesn't he? 12 verse 19, truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue lasts only for a moment. And perhaps that final reference to eternity exposes the ultimate reason why words, for all their power to influence, are in the end quite weak things. And that is because God, who is the author of speech, evaluates and judges them. Like that card that people have up on their wall says, he's the silent listener to every conversation. He can penetrate, says Solomon, into the heart motivations behind our excuses. 24 verse 12, if you excuse yourself, doesn't he who weighs the heart perceive it, he says? He's not taken in by what we say, you see. He reads our minds. He can identify the liar, even if everybody else is duped by his deceit. And he hates it. 12:22, the Lord detests lying lips, says Solomon. In fact, in chapter 6, in verses 16 to 19, Solomon lists seven things which God detests, which God hates. They all relate to different parts of the anatomy. The haughty eye, the murderous hands, the feet that run to do evil, the heart that plans mischief. But in that list of seven, it's significant, I think, that the lips are by implication mentioned three times. Lying lips, he says. A false witness, a man who stirs up dissension among brothers. All these are sins of the tongue. It's as if to confirm James's observation that of all the members of our body, the tongue is the most treacherous. James says if a man can control his tongue, he can control anything. He says just like a horse, a huge powerful beast, can be controlled by means of a small piece of metal in its mouth. Or just like a ship, though it's tossed about by a mighty tempest, still the helmsman can steer it accurately by means of a very small rudder. He says, in the same way, the tongue may be a very small thing in the body, but it has a significance out of all proportion to its size. If you can control that, you've got your whole personality under control, he says. But of course it's difficult. Who is the master horseman who can teach us to bridle our words? Who's the master pilot who can teach us to steer our conversation? It takes more than natural human ability to do it. James says, no man can tame the tongue. No man? Peter says, no deceit was found on his mouth. They wondered at his gracious words that came from his lips. No man ever spoke like this man, they said. Now, words are the index of the heart. Only the Son of God has ever shown us what mastery of the tongue really meant. Always true, always noble, always humble, never undisciplined, never garrulous, never hasty, never malicious. They wondered at his words. And he's the only one who's going to enable us to control our tongues, isn't he? Let's pray together.